Hey everyone, thanks for checking out another podcast. With everything that's been going on, I'm really glad today to have Rick Schumacher. He's a fellow Tillman scholar, friend of mine, with us to talk about the instability, you know, the uprisings, the election on the horizon, the talk and actual deployment of federal troops to a bunch of U.S. cities, sometimes against the wishes of local officials. And I just worry, and for the first time in my adult life, about the stability of the United States. So Rick is, does corporate investigations for a large multinational corporation, also has his own consulting firm doing investigations, fraud investigations, that type of thing. And in an earlier life, in Iraq, he was a member of a psychological operations unit and is familiar with psychological operations, PSYOPs. So today we have a conversation about psychological operations in the age of Black Lives Matter, how information and propaganda is being used by various institutions and entities within our society to control public opinion. It's really fascinating. It's a little intimidating. It's going to be interesting to see how the next few months play out. But we have some a fascinating conversation. We talk about the dangers we're currently facing, the state response, the division, the upcoming election. We even talk about like what happens if the president, if there's a close election, the president loses and he refuses to leave. What is that going to look like? So it's a wide-ranging conversation. It's really interesting. I want you to sit back and enjoy it. If you want to support the show, please subscribe on whatever platform you're on. Write a review if you're on iTunes or whatever platform you're on. Really appreciate it. And also, just a little bit of news. I had my first op-ed published in The Guardian, the British paper, and it's a pretty big deal for me as just a beat cop to get something written in The Guardian, published in The Guardian. So if you want to show me some support, head over and give it a read. You can find it on my website under the publications tab. Just go to thomasowenbaker.com to check out my website. Click on the publications and you'll find that article and give it a read. I talk about the use of lethal force in the United States, and I'd really appreciate it if you check it out. So thank you for checking out the podcast. Sit back and enjoy. Hey, thanks for coming by and hanging out with me. I gave like a brief introduction, told the audience sort of who you are and a little bit about you, but can you maybe, just so that we know, I do this with everyone who comes on, just maybe tell us a little bit about who you are as a person, so we know like what kind of lens you have. Like, maybe can you start with where you grew up?
This is one of my stories. I grew up all over the place. I lived in 36 houses and cars by the time I was 18. Uh-huh. So, single mom situation. She was involved in the drug culture, and so we moved around a lot. I was born in Seattle, grew up all over Texas. Joined the army when I could, and here I am.
So you joined the army when you could. It was like, so you know, you were living in cars, really sort of
yeah,
difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I was on my own. I was on my own when I was 16. So, finished high school. Surprisingly, ended up with a real low GPA, but I was working full time. So, at the end of the day, that's what I had to do. But the army was kind of my way out. I mean, not just that. I mean, that's how a lot of people end up there. But, my grandparents served, my father served. I mean, I have a long lineage of people that served, but I was, you know, I used to like to say, oh, I joined because my family was in the military, but really it was because, you know, I didn't want to end up in prison.
That's not unusual. I know I had a guy went through like basic training, AIT, airborne, a bunch of training, and his name was one, like he was a B as well. His last name started with a B, Ben Wellos. I'll just say his name. And he was from Escondido, California, and I had shown up at basic training, and I had never had any kind of personal relationship with someone of Mexican heritage. Like, just I'd never had any friends or where I'd gone to school. Mm-hmm. It was in the Northeast or in Canada. Those, and just didn't have a lot of people from Mexico. And his he had a completely different experience than I had had. I had kind of had the GPA issue, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and But he was like literally like using the military as a way to escape. He thought he was in like physical danger in his neighborhood. He didn't know what to do, and he didn't know how to get out of there, and he didn't have any place to go. So he went to a recruiter and was like, sign me up. They talked about this delayed sort of entry thing. And he's like, no, I need to go now. I need to get the hell out of here, kind of a thing. So I think that's not an uncommon sort of thing for folks that I met in the military. I noticed like I was in an infantry unit, and a lot of the folks were just people that a lot of the motivation was they were running away from something, I found. So what did your did you maintain a relationship with your mom after that? Like, if you don't mind me asking, or?
No, she was, she was in the drug world, like I said. Then she, sobered up over, probably a few years after I was gone, and we have had a relationship since then. We've tried. Now she's, unfortunately in a nursing home, a little earlier than she should have been, but what are you gonna do? But yeah, I still maintain good contact with her.
Yeah, I had a similar thing. My dad was had real severe problems with alcohol, and it ended up taking a ton of time off of his life, and made the relate like having relationships with the family almost impossible. So I can empathize with it. What so you where was it that you were so you were moving around a lot from sort of living in vehicles and having this difficult time? Where was it? It was in California, did you say?
No, for most of the time, most of my life was in
It was in
Texas.
Texas.
So, from the Panhandle to Corpus Christi to the Metroplex in Dallas, just all over.
Okay, so
So
your
yeah,
experience was in Texas, and then you make your way into
mostly,
and then
yeah.
you make your way into the military, and you're sort of looking. Did you know what you were heading into? Did you have any kind of real idea of what it was going to be like?
Yeah, I mean, I'd always been interested in that world, and I got into a pretty cool job right off the bat. So hit that right ASVAB score, and they invited me into a psychological operations job specialty. So I did that for 12 years. I finished my last year was in Iraq in 2003 to 2004, and then I came back to Texas.
So people who are listening to this, they may not be familiar with, and I'm, to be honest, I'm not, I know, I sort of have like this basic idea of what like PSYOPs, like psychological operations unit does. Can you maybe just sort of tell us like what is it?
Sure. Well, psychological operations in the U.S. military is using different communication techniques to inform and influence foreign adversaries and well, foreigners, foreign nationals in general. This can be done at different levels, from the tactical level where you've got a Humvee with a big speaker truck with a big speaker mounted on the top, yelling surrender appeals and things like that. Infantry dudes might have that's what you would have seen from a PSYOP, from the PSYOP guys. They would have been the ones blasting AC/DC before a raid, that kind of thing. But then there's also different levels of things, key leader engagements, working with host nation military. The psychological operation falls under the SOF umbrella in the Army, so it's actually part of First Special Forces Command. We're not green beanies or anything like that, but they're, the smartest guy on a watching a radio on a 12-man team. But generally, what we're doing is just using either radio, leaflets, interpersonal communication techniques to influence the battlefield non-kinetically. So by saying, "Hey, we're looking for Uday Hussein," we're the guys that are actually putting that messaging out there about, here's what we're looking for, here's where we're going to pay you. All of those types of very direct communications, and then also We have radio systems that we can implement and have host nation locals broadcast, and they can be influencing messages that are they're overt or covert, different levels of
So
communication.
you mean like when you talk about this communication, so you're talking about you could be broadcasting like, hey, we're broadcasting this information trying to influence the population. When you say covert, are you talking about like interrupting the other side's chain of command and sending signals, or are you talking about
Well, that gets into EW or electronic warfare. That's not really our angle, but we do have access to communication platforms that jam civilian and military channels, and we can just lay in communications over that, and that can be, the Americans are here to help you. Don't fire on American forces. Hey, this is what happened. This is when people forces surrender appeals, all that sort of thing. And we can do that from the strategic level where we're operating out of Fort Bragg and we're uploading communication packets and they're being sent to maybe whole combat theaters, to it could be very tactical where I'm shaking hands with locals, engaging key communicators to get them to influence their communities in a way that positively brings about peaceful resolutions or at least deconflicts what the military is doing in the area.
okay. So would it be fair to say that the job is to, like, this may sound corny or whatever, but everyone has heard, to win the hearts and minds of the people that are in the country, or is it to demoralize certain elements within the society? Maybe you have the opposing military or elements within the society, or is it a sort of a messy combination of both?
It's a combination of both. It depends on what you're tasked with, but yeah, you could be working to demoralize. So, like in a kinetic environment, you're probably going to be spending a lot of time doing demoralization techniques when you have a, you
Can you
know,
back up? You said you said it a couple times. I know kind of know what kinetic means. Can
right.
you talk about
Sorry.
what you mean? No, it's fine. Can you
So,
explain it?
in a shooting war, where there's people that are you've got. The what we would call the good guys and the bad guys, and everybody's fighting everybody. We would be there working to do surrender appeals and demoralization type communications. But that also changes when you're looking at an insurgency or something like that. We're going to be trying to affect the local populace to reduce how those insurgents are accepted in those communities, using all sorts of influence techniques to try to separate what we call the bad guys from the civilian population so that, they don't have a permissive environment. They can't operate easily. And that happens, and then it doesn't happen. It really, I mean, there's just a lot of factors that go into if that actually happens.
Yeah, I can imagine, and I would imagine, like, as time goes by, the mission is constantly changing, the objectives are changing, so what you guys are doing on the ground is going to be constantly changing to meet the needs of that mission. So you talk about this really wide range of responsibilities that these type of units take on. Can you talk about, so you were in at the end of, near the end of your career, you were in Iraq. Like pretty soon after the invasion, am I right?
I was there for the invasion. We came
Okay,
across the
so
berm.
okay, so you were there for the invasion, and then how long were you in Iraq?
It was a 12-month tour. I spent the last month and a half in Qatar working for what they call SOCCENT, which is Special Operations Command Central, working at their location there in out of country. So I spent about 9, 10. Yeah, about 10 and a half months in country in
And
Iraq.
can I ask you sort of like what was your, just so I know sort of what your perspective was on war at that time, what were your thoughts? You're a young, much younger person. I don't know how much you were thinking about global politics at that point in your life, but I know you're engaged in those, you're actively interested in those topics now. What were your sort of, not now, but back then when you were this young man, what were your perspectives on what was happening at that point?
Well, I mean, in that job specialty, we spend a lot of time working the embassies, working in country teams with ambassadors and things of that nature. Even as a young buck sergeant or corporal, you're expected to operate at the diplomatic level. It's kind of different than a lot of other military positions. So I did get a lot of insights
Yeah,
even before.
corporals weren't even allowed to talk to lieutenants where I was. So, go ahead, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
I got a lot of insight into how what I consider how the world really worked, which is a lot different than that sort of myopic view. If you're just sitting in a barracks day after day training, you don't really get a big world view, from my opinion. In my opinion, but. When you get out, when you go do trainings like Cobra Gold or something like that, you don't go do these international trainings, you get a lot more influence from how the world really looks. And I took that over my entire career, to the point where I really didn't even want to go to Iraq. I thought it was the wrong place to be. I agreed with being in Afghanistan, but it was my job to do, and if I didn't do it, somebody else was going to do it, and I couldn't live with that. So I did my job, and then promptly got out afterwards. Hit my enlistment, and I was done. But yeah, I mean, people come into it for a lot of different reasons. There's things I support about, I'm. About how we operated there. There's things that I think we could have done a lot different. Not being there was one of them,
Right.
but we were. So try to do the best you can. And in my opinion, my job specialty was about trying to save lives, keep people from getting into situations where they had to shoot. So, for instance, checkpoints. There's a early on, there was a bunch of problems about how Joes or military folks were, manning checkpoints, and they didn't have any real ability to communicate with the people that were coming up, were riding up onto them. So, I mean, in our culture, you put your fist up, this is stop, right? That might not be how they receive that. They might not understand. So, finding ways as a communication specialist, as an intercultural communication specialist, to deconflict or make those things less kinetic, less violent. That was what I think my goal was.
Okay, so it was sort of bridging the gap between the understanding that the soldiers had of any given situation and the perception of the situation that the civilians in country had in any given situation, so that it lowered the likelihood that there would be a violent encounter. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, tried. I mean, I don't want to disparage troops on the ground. The problem is, your regular infantry dude got maybe 3 hours of cultural
Right.
communications training before they went in country. They did not have the information that they needed to go there. So, we would come up with ideas or ways to try to bridge that gap. But they did what they had to do. They did the best they could with what they had. I just think that, what we did was we were, good about helping them make signage. This is what you need to write. This is, how far out you need to have your first checkpoint and then your primary checkpoint. I mean, there's different things that they could do that, they're skilled in one thing, we're skilled in another thing, and if we combine those skill sets, then we were able to reduce the impact of the checkpoints, for
Right.
instance.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of it as like there was anything wrong, like that the soldiers were doing anything wrong. I think it's that, like what you say, like the military and the way it should be in policing is that there's training and standards. So you set standards for your soldiers, and then you provide them the adequate training so they have the skills that are required to meet those standards. And you guys wanted those standards raised, and you needed training and signs or whatnot. And it reminds me of policing. I see the same gap between civilians' perceptions of encounters with the police. So they enter an encounter with police, and they may, you know, they don't understand why the officer is doing a lot of the things they're doing. And then police officers, they're the same way. They get funneled into just doing things as a routine, and they just assume that people know what they want them to do. And there's a lot of miscommunication, like especially with high risk situations where officers are trying to get people out of a car at gunpoint, and they're yelling commands, and it's confusing. And I think a way to reduce violence here in the United States is to bring those, like, to help officers better communicate with civilians and to educate civilians on what more about what's happening in policing. Yeah, I think it's very similar. Sorry to go off on, I go off on tangents, so I apologize.
That's all right. But I mean, I actually have a really good analogy there. It's the schizophrenic voice. When you're doing a high risk stop, right? You've got the primary that's got eyes on, let's say, the guy in the front seat of a car. And then you got a secondary, and then you might have two or three other cops that are maneuvering around. A lot of times, I mean, you should have one voice. You should have one person giving commands, talking to the subject, and trying to build that communication. But in a lot of videos I've seen and in a lot of encounters I've seen, you have that primary guy, and then you've got other people, other officers that are all of them are talking. All of them are giving commands. Hands up. Don't move. Yeah. Stand up. Turn around. And that is really confusing. I mean, just at its simplest form, it's a confusing situation. It's very volatile. So the guy's already not processing, right? He's not processing well. It's all motor memory. It's all very basic understanding of anything. And then you've got so many people communicating, trying to communicate with him, that it's impossible for him to understand what to do.
Absolutely.
And I see that time and time again in these videos where it's just like, you know, just good communication techniques would do so much for them, for everybody, to make everybody safer. But that's a soft skill, or it's considered a soft skill. And it's not, you can't check mark box it. You can't put that into a performance review. Oh, you're good at your soft skills, right? I mean, that's something that has to be bred in over time. And I think that's one of the problems we have.
Absolutely. And we know these things, like in policing, this is known, like, you know, you need to have a person that's designated to communicate, and you need to give the sort of clear, concise commands. You can't have everyone yelling. We know these things, but it seems like when I watch these videos almost, and in my own experience in law enforcement, once that adrenaline gets shot in, and a lot of times those things go out the window, and what kicks in is the last, you know, is just, if it's not something that you've trained over and over and over again and reinforced, then you're not going to do it under stress. So it's something, so like police go to the police academy, they learn how to do this. They learn the techniques that have been refined on how to do a high risk vehicle stop in very safe ways. And it changes over time as we learn more, and it's very sophisticated techniques that have been developed, but they're given this short period of instruction, and then they go out onto the street, and then they go to work, and it's never really reinforced. I would like to see police officers on their shift going into parking lots for periods of time and practicing high-risk vehicle stops, you know, like, or on the driving track away from the civilians or whatever, practicing pulling non-compliant officers, doing scenarios, non-compliant people out of vehicles. But that's not how police officers train. They train on the job, out on the street. It's shocking. It's shocking to me.
Right. Well, and that's what I think. I mean, as an infantry dude, you probably would never imagine going through a training lane without a weapon, right? That's your gig. I go through training. I used to run training lanes where you never saw a weapon because it was all about communicating. It was all about, let's see how we can understand each other and communicate in very stressful situations with non-compliant people and not put your hands on them, right? Not put guns on them, because once you go to guns, the game is over. I'm on a three-man PSYOP team. I might have one other gun truck with me. Other than that, we're it. So you're not going to win. And so you really all the time, and we would do training lanes, you know, in country. We would do training lanes when we were in garrison. You would always be training on how to engage people. And that soft skill was our skill. So
let me jump. I was going to ask you this eventually, but you touch on this, the training. Well, we touched on it. So let's imagine you know quite a bit about policing. You have some education in criminal justice. You've worked in this a sort of similar process overseas. Like it's very similar. It's like policing and a counterinsurgency seem, you know, I'm going to phrase this question. So let's imagine that you're now in charge of a company of soldiers and so you're in charge of a platoon of soldiers and you've been assigned responsibility for a small geographic area in a city like Chicago for the next year. Your police officers, your soldiers have all worked as police officers in the civilian world for several years. They're reservists, let's say. And so they have all the basic training that's required to do the job. Now you're responsible for ensuring that they are trained, and you've been told you can provide them much training as necessary. You have the budget for it and the manpower to cover the person power to cover the streets. If they're working 40 hours a week, now, like when I worked 40, if I worked 40, 50 hours as a police officer, almost always that was just me out working and doing my job. If you were in charge of that unit, what percentage or how many hours of that 40 hours a week, if any, would you devote to training?
20%. Yeah, and not just like hip pocket training or you know window to window training with your FTO, but you know, like off the street training, seminars. You know, get people out there. I mean, I actually ran for constable, which is a law enforcement position in Texas, and one of my platform pieces was, you know, community engagement, right? So what I wanted those officers to do, those deputy constables, was to take off their gun belts and work on, for 20% of their time, work on volunteer like builds, things like that, that gets them involved in the community, right? So one aspect is community engagement, but really, I think in a very important part is you pull back off the street and really focus in on those training lines, understanding how to engage people. If you build that muscle memory, right, out off the line, outside of off the street, then when you get to the street, you have a different perspective, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know. I'm not a street cop. I've never been a street cop. There's something to be said about being able to understand the street like that. But I think that if you're there all the time, 100% of your time is sitting there getting hit like that, you know, it's a recipe for disaster. So I would say 20% of that time you're pulled out, you're doing training, you're re-engaging, and then you can go back in.
So just to put it in context, 20%, you're saying that if a police officer, they're working five days a week, you would say that one of those full days would be devoted to just not answering calls, not even the community engagement, but training and reinforcing skills.
Right.
That are required. And you're saying not just going to the range, but like,
right. You're not learning how to communicate. I'm not talking about range days, man. Right. you get plenty of that.
Absolutely.
I'm talking about, you know, just stepping out and for me, I think one of the biggest problems we have is being able to communicate eloquently, you know, past the blue line with people, because there's been so much of a a mentality that's been built up that I've seen where, you know, the civilian is the potential enemy all the time, right? And that's going to be the case. They're always there. That's just the way the people are trained in law enforcement now. You always have to be aware that that guy in front of you is going to pop off on you constantly. Right. So I think that's wrong. I think that's a problem. But I think that being able to communicate bridges that divide, regardless if you think they're an enemy. I mean, I communicated with terrorists, you know, I communicated with people I knew would kill me if they could. But I did it in a way that built empathy and allowed them that space. And we were able to communicate. And I think that that kept people alive.
And I can tell you firsthand, having worked with investigators in a variety of different roles and investigated a variety of different crimes from shopliftings all the way up to homicides, that the very best way to manage a suspect, even if they've done the most, especially if they've done horrible things, is to build strong lines of communication with them and to treat them with dignity and respect, to explain what's happening to them and build as deep a rapport as possible. Make sure they have something to eat, make sure they have some food, treat them like a human being, and then invest a lot of front end time in the conversation before you even ask a question about what happened. And you'll get the best interviews. You'll get, people will tell you things. Like the best, one of the best detectives I ever worked with, this guy named, I won't even say his name, but he worked organized crime. He worked white power types and that, Aryan Brotherhood type of thing, like white prison gangs. And he would spend an hour talking to someone about what they'd been reading while they were locked up in the jail. The Sheriff Joe would only let them have these crappy romance novels. So make them wear pink underwear, keep them locked in a cage for 23 hours a day, and then only let them read romance novels. Like, it's a kind of torture. Yeah. He knew that it was brutal. I listened to these jail tapes of these people, and it's crazy. Anyway, he would go into a room and he knew what they were reading and had actually familiarized himself with what they were reading, and then had conversations with them and joked about, so it's what you're talking about. This ability to have these deep communications. A lot of times police officers, they don't fully understand. A lot of them do, the best ones do, but a lot of them, they discount the value of that there, even if you're trying to be in a, put people in prison.
Right. Well, so from my perspective now, I'm an investigator with a multinational corporation. So I do white collar fraud investigations internally, embezzlement and things like that. So it's not violent stuff. It's always, stolen. But we're talking about, all the way from some low level staffer that went to a strip club with his credit card to a chair of the company who stole multi-billions of dollars from the company, right? So you come into these events and you already believe that guy's a bad guy, right? He's bad and I'm good and that's it. If you come into an interview like that, you're never going to be able to bridge that gap. So I look at my past experience and I think about, a lot of people might not be familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but so Maslow posits that there's different levels of needs. There's physiological needs. I need to eat. I need to sleep, right? And then there's higher level needs. And then higher level, there's just steps of needs that you have. So when you look at an executive who steals a whole bunch of money, you can come into it as, oh, he's just a greedy dude. Or you could come into it, oh, he has a special need. What is that need? How can I empathize with it? How can I understand it? And how can I picture him not as a bad guy, but as another guy, as another person just like me? And when you can get your mind wrapped around that. You can do that from a CEO of a company to a criminal on the street to a terrorist in Iraq. You can empathize. You can build rapport through empathy, through understanding, and that makes things happen. It makes it to where you're not going to get into an altercation. It makes it to where you can get them to communicate with you. And people, but you just have to imagine that the you know, average street that's trained a certain way. That guy, it's a pretext stop. I think he's got drugs. He's a bad guy. I'm going to do a hard stop on, right? So he does that. And instead of trying to build rapport, he goes hard. And if you go hard, there's a higher probability that bad things are going to happen. You know? Absolutely. So, absolutely. Again, I think it all comes back to communications. I'm just kind of going round and round on that.
But. No, you're absolutely right. And I had the good mentors that I had in policing told me early on that your goal at the end of any encounter should be for the person. If you have to take somebody to jail, then that person, when you take them to jail, should want to shake your hand and thank you for treating them with dignity and respect and understanding how they, and I mean, having a conversation with someone, just saying like, really, you know, like, and letting them know that you understand how I, in that same situation, might've made that decision. And people also, I found in my interviews, was that people, if they were gonna tell you something, like if they were gonna just let it out and turn the faucet on and start telling you everything, that it was because they saw like a path forward, like a way that they could sort of redeem themselves, you know, like that they could tell a story, that this was gonna be a story they could tell you that you were gonna be able to absorb in an understanding and compassionate way. If you're just going to be some asshole who thinks they're a piece of shit for doing it, why are they going to, you know, like there's no like way for them to save face. There's no like safe way for them to tell you what they probably in a lot of cases actually want to get off their chest.
Yeah. Most of the time, most people want to tell you things. People love to talk. It's just a natural thing. I've found
this guy right here. For sure.
But you're right. It's about a path forward. If you know, you go hard on something, you make it to where they are boxed in, and you know that it makes it more difficult to get them to speak or communicate or comply. Right? If you say, "Asshole, if you don't do what I'm going to tell you to do, I'm going to pull you through your window." Right? That's one way of going about it. Or maybe step back. Put some distance. Be like, hey, we have a horrible day today, buddy. And I'm sure you're having a pretty bad day too, right? Build a rapport, communicate, take the extra time. It's going to suck. It's going to take a lot of your time, but what else are you going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. Go hard and, you know, and then
go hard and write a lot of reports or maybe kill somebody. And then, then where are you at?
Exactly. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and you can answer this as much or as little as you want, but I'm just curious if you put on your sort of like psychological operations warfare kind of hat, and you think about the United States as like just some other country, not your own home, like try to, you know, if you could be as objective as you can be, and you see this move to put federal police into American cities. Or the conversation, I guess it's sort of getting a little sketchy now if it's going to happen or not. Do you see this as a legitimate sort of response to the threatening, you know, these buildings being threatened? Is it a political move to shore up, or is it a combination of the two?
Well, I mean, are the buildings being threatened? Probably. I mean, federal properties are being threatened. Is it a good idea to engage in that way? I would say no. Again, you want to, you know, not have the federal buildings be threatened, right? And so the best way to do that, in my opinion, wouldn't be to make, put something out in front of those federal buildings that pisses people off even more, and, just ratchet up that situation, right? You'd want to de-escalate, and you don't de-escalate with the barrel of a gun. That's not how it works. Do you
think this is something that, do you think this is just a misguided sort of understanding where, because a lot of people, I know some nice folks who this is the natural response that they come to, like, okay, well, they're doing this, we're going to respond with force. Or do you think that this is something where people I'm saying, as president of the United States, you have a cabinet, you have access to all of these thinkers. Do you think this is politically driven, or do you think this is just a poor decision making?
Well, hell, I'm not in any position to make any calls about it, but I mean, if you had really smart thinkers thinking about how to reduce violence and this sort of anarchy that they're saying is happening, which I don't actually see a whole lot of, but if that was accurate, then I think those smart thinkers should think about ways to de-escalate the situation, and the opposite would be the escalation of the situation. Those smart thinkers thinking it's a good idea to escalate the situation, which is what they're doing. So, I mean, logically speaking, it doesn't look like the folks that are in power are working to de-escalate anything. They are, it's criminology, right? If they're being forthcoming, if they're doing what they think is right, then I would have to say they're looking at like general crime control theory. I'm going to taunt you hard enough, long enough, you're going to stop doing what I don't want you to do. Right. I'm going to hit you on the head with this battering ram until you stop doing things. That's, classical ways of thinking. And some people are really like that. In fact, I have a lot of friends that's, their kind of police tactic is to, I'm just going to keep hitting this until it hurts you enough and you don't want to do it anymore. But unfortunately, that's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at, fighting systemic violence. We're looking at, the Black Lives Matter movement is, way beyond criminality. It's not criminal. It's not something that needs to be taunted. It's not something that needs to be hit on the head. It's something that needs to be understood and engaged. And you don't do that with a line of federal agents. You do that with talkers. You do that with people that can communicate, that people that can bring people to the table and come up with solutions, as opposed to just building more walls.
So if you're, let's change the scenario and say you're back in Iraq or you're in some other country and you're advising local officials on how to handle a similar situation. So there's these long, historical, deeply systemic issues that involve race or tribe or some other individual characteristic that create this imbalance in power and that, hundreds of years of oppression, and there's all this resentment and systemic race, it's a very similar problem, and the state is responding the way they are, way we are right now. What would your advice be at a practical level? Like, you talk about engaging them with people who can talk, like, how would that look if you were advising the president of the United States? What would you suggest he do?
Well, I could give you a very particular, for instance. We were on the Iranian border dealing with, we had brought the Peshmerga, the Kurdish fighters, down from the north, and they were working with us, and we got to a certain town, and this was one of their ancestral homes, this group of Peshmerga fighters. And the promise that was made to them by the folks before us was that they could go back to their homes, right? And when they got there, unfortunately, those homes were filled up with folks that Saddam had brought in from Baghdad, right? So what happens was, and nobody knew what was exactly going on, but you had Kurds starting to fight with the Arab population, and you had the Turks or Turkmen, smaller community, fighting. Everybody started fighting, and a lot of this was coming from influence provided by some folks on the other side of that border. But it was a shit show. It was a mess, right? And you know, you could look at it and just say, "Oh, this is a bunch of sectarian violence. We're just going to come in and put walls up and separate everybody, and we'll stop that violence with you know, bigger walls and more guns. And so we'll send in 4ID, 4th Infantry Division. We're gonna just stop it all." Or you could understand what the problem is. So you get people in a room. And we did, and we said, why is everybody fighting? We need to understand this better. So we found out that, you know, that there was it was a home issue. It was, they wanted their homes, their ancestral homes, and the Arabs that were living there wanted to stay in their homes. A very simple dispute, right? But there was no solution until we created one. We created a tribunal that provided everybody an equal voice. All three of the different factions were, you know, had elected their leader for that tribunal, and people were able to come forward and say, "This is my home, and this is the documents that I have to do it." So they created a legal system, you know, and that legal system made the violence disappear because it gave people an outlet. Now, not everybody was happy with the results, because somebody had to leave a home or stay in a home, but they had a voice. And I think that voice is the most important thing. And so when we look at the situations we have now, you have people, you know, millions of us raising our voice and yelling and demanding, but there's no place for that voice to be heard. So it's just yelling at walls. It's yelling and now burning, and things are happening, but there's not a commission that's been opened up. There's not some sort of way to get these voices, what we really want, to be consolidated into one voice that, you know, can be spoken in the government or in some way that validates it, right? Right now, we're still just screaming, and you know, nobody's listening.
No, do you think that, like, say tomorrow, Donald Trump were to have some, like, Ebenezer Scrooge type experience where he changes his view on the world, and tomorrow he wakes up and says, "I've seen the light, and I really want to, like, heal the wounds in American society, and there's deep injustice related to race in this country, and we need to take steps to address it, and we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission." Do you think that he has any? Do you think that he would have? I mean, if this sounds, this is ridiculous that this is going to happen. But if it did, do you think that he would be capable, given his previous performance? Would he be capable of serving that function?
I individually don't believe so. I mean, from my personal beliefs, I think that he's incapable of doing that for a number of reasons, primarily because I don't believe he believes in that sort of reconciliation. I believe that a lot of people don't. I think that they think, you know, well, everything's okay. These people are just angry, right? We know that that's not true. We can see the facts, but they're going to have their beliefs and they're going to stick to them. I think that if I was president for the day, I would create a cabinet level commission on race and equality, and focus on, you know, create a platform of what are the eight most important things that are affected by inequality in race. and bring people to the table, you know, consolidate people from the Black Lives Matter movement, consolidate, bring people in and have their voices heard.
You know, what you say there kind of reminds me of at the university. I was at a program in Arizona. It was like a program dedicated to like social justice. So they were bringing in people who were, you know, very, you know, devoted, and people who worked on prison reform, some radical thinkers. And when I was there at a certain point, I kind of came to the conclusion that this served utility in a number of ways. But one of the ways is that you were finding people who were perhaps some of the most disaffected people within society, and giving them like a place and funding them. So the government was actually coming in and paying them to think these ways and to share that information, to work together and consult, you know, get their, and then it's like a co-opting of people. Is that kind of what you're talking about when you say consolidate?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, we have so many voices in the movement right now. There are so many, different, very important voices, but it's a cacophony. It's loud, but it's not focused. I mean, we're all saying the same things. We all want the same things, but you know, it's easier for the government or our opposition to quell us or to limit us by saying, you know, by just disconnecting from those voices. Mm-hmm. So if you were able to consolidate those voices, like in Austin, we have this group called the Austin Justice Coalition, right? So the AJC, it's amazing. What they've done is they've looked at, they've brought in all of the different desperate groups that are focused on, you know, social justice and prison reform and law enforcement reform and, you know, not getting shot for no reason. They've brought them all in kind of under an umbrella, and they've worked with them, and they've created a voice through a few very well-spoken people that really know and live in this world, and it's given them this voice, and they can sit down with the chief of police at APD pretty much any day of the week. They say, hey, the guy that kind of runs the whole deal, a guy named Chaz Moore, he's an amazing, amazing advocate. And he's a great guy. He can say, I want to have a meeting with the chief of APD. And he has it, right? Because he's got a consolidated voice. He's got everybody pushing for one thing. Right. Everybody's rowing in the same direction. When you have so many different groups that aren't consolidated or aren't given the microphone, right, then it's easy to push them out. It's easy to push them away. But if everybody's consolidated and there's that one voice, then it's going to be heard.
And you're suggesting that this be, you talked about your dictator for the day, president for the day kind of thing. You can do what you know, dictator perpetua, whatever you want to call it. You can do whatever you want. And you sort of talked a minute ago about that you would want to consolidate these voices sort of in a national, at a national level. So you go out and find these voices and consolidate them. Let's say that this election goes the other way and Joe Biden is the next president of the United States. Do you feel as though that his administration will have the capacity or the inclination to undertake something like that? Or what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I think he definitely would make space for it. Certainly. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a politician. I don't know how he would do it. I don't know that if after the election, you know, all this is in the rearview mirror and he's moving on to different things, but this is something that's not going away, no. Right? It's not. It is time. It is time for systemic change. And you can't do that piecemeal. You can't do that at 18,000 different departments across the country. You have to do that at the largest place you can. You have to do that in the executive office. You have to do that at the top.
And we have, so let's, I'm sorry to give you all these hypotheticals. This is just, obviously we're not, you're not saying this is the way it is, or this is just your perspective as a person who worked PsyOps and you did these deployments, you're coming back, you're seeing your own country go through this sort of, I would say it's like this really low boil sort of civil conflict that we're in right now. I think it's, I feel comfortable saying, and I think homicide rates, we've had some assassinations, people killed. I mean, this is serious. What if we were to have some attempt, a concerted effort with skilled communicators to consolidate these voices and put forward an agenda, do you feel as though, given the current level of division that exists within society and this rather significant portion of Americans who seem to be looking for a strong man, this sort of right wing 1930s style, Do you feel as though that can be something that is successful in the current environment?
Well, honestly, I think that group of people who want that 1930s style strongman are very few. I think they're amplified by, you know, a right wing that doesn't know what to do with them, doesn't know how to keep them in their bottle, doesn't know how to turn them away anymore, because some of those strong men folk have gotten into very high level positions. And the fact is, I don't think, if there's a new administration, I think that goes away. But regardless, you know, I think that there are reasonable people on both sides of this argument that want safety and security. They want things. They have no idea how to get there. And I'm not talking, I don't think that the far folks, the fascists that exist are those people. They're not reasonable people. We can't talk to them. They're not who I'm talking about. I'm talking about that more centrist, right-leaning person who just wants to be able to go to work, and he just thinks that the cops should be able to talk who they want to talk because that's the American way. I think that guy, I don't agree with him, but I think that he can be talked to. You can discuss those things. You can come up with solutions with a reasonable person, even if that reasonable person is somebody who I would personally say, I don't agree with anything you have to say. I would probably consider you a racist, even though they would never say that. They're not, oh, I'm not a racist. I have black friends, all that stuff. But they're in a position where they believe in this classical conservatism concept, right? And I don't agree with it, but I can talk to it. If you bring those people to the table as well, the reasonable people that are willing to discuss and willing to come up with pathways, that are willing to come up with solutions, that's who we need. That's who this should be. This shouldn't be just a group of people who want one thing, right? It should be a group of people who want the same thing, but are coming from very diverse ways of getting there, right? So I think that in the current administration, there's no chance of that. But I think that with a different administration, you would see that potential come up, even with our conservative counterparts, right? As long as we're not continuing down this siloed, this uber-divided society that's being created more and more every day. There's more and more division being sewn in. And you bring up low intensity conflict. You brought that up a few minutes ago. And that is actually one of the psychological warfare concepts. We work in low intensity conflict. So do our adversaries. They operate in low intensity conflict. They build on our divisions. And I promise you, I 100% promise that is happening today. There are foreign influences operating to sow our divisions and to make us more divided. I guarantee you.
We do the same thing. I mean, it works, right?
We do the same thing, right?
And this is one of the things that it's reminded me of, like this. I feel like I'm in South America, like a couple decades ago, and I have like I feel like I'm in a CIA operation a lot of the time. I don't know. Maybe like you're saying, it's these foreign adversaries, but I wonder. Like, it feels like internally as well, there are people with powerful interests that are benefit from this.
Definitely. I mean, you wouldn't know who. I mean. A psychological warfare campaign has to have a certain few things to be considered propaganda. It has to be a campaign, and it has to have a direction. It has to have a purpose, right? It has to have a specific thing they're trying to influence, right? So that could be a cabal of business people. It could be an oligarchy. It could be a foreign government. It could be a terrorist group. It could be a whole lot of things, right? And propaganda on its face is not necessarily a bad thing. Right. I mean, people like to put it as a bad thing, but really it's just influence.
Don't smoke cigarettes. That's propaganda, right?
Right. That is propaganda. Right. Exactly. It's just got that bad term to it. So, and I understand people are going to believe or understand propaganda as the bad thing, but so we use the term product. If you have certain products that, you know, we're putting out and BLM, for instance, the big yellow BLMs, Black Lives Matter down the road. Mm-hmm. That's a product that is trying to influence a certain way. Right. And it's amazing. And it's great. That's very overt. That's where we're coming from. What they call, there's three types of propaganda. There's black, gray, and white. So, white product is something that's overt, open, and it says I'm the person who created this product and I'm putting it out there and that's it. Gray is where you don't know where it came from, right? It's just stuff that's out there in the ether, and we see that a lot. And then there's the bad stuff, right? You see the black propaganda where it's the message is coming from somebody who it's not really coming from, right? It's misattributed on purpose. And we see that as well, though it's harder to find. But I mean, all of those things occur, and they're all occurring right now. I would say that the resistance, if you want to call it that, doesn't have a sophisticated propaganda development. So they're not going to hit those other things, but our opposition definitely does. You do see that. You see the similarities in the construct of the way communications are coming out. You see phraseology. Now you'll see the resistance. I mentioned it a couple minutes ago. I'm seeing the word resistance coming from all sorts of people because it's put in there on purpose. Right. It's a purposeful statement. And you see it. I saw it on my local Texas senator's communications recently. I've seen it from the president's office. I've seen it in a lot of different places, and that's purposeful.
Yeah, you'll see communication. I'll see that on the Sunday news shows. You'll see this little snippets where the same word or phrase is said by all these different people, and then throughout the week, you'll see it. People reiterate it and constantly plugging it. Just so that people mm-hmm. hear it enough. It's like they're trying to get enough, like on social media, they're trying to get enough impressions, and they know if they get enough impressions that they'll get enough clicks. Like it's like very, sometimes some of them seem right. more sophisticated than others. So you talk about this like a campaign and messaging that has like a purpose. There's this, when you see this, like over the weekend, I heard tons of talk. Not over the weekend, this week I've heard tons. I forgot without the COVID and everything, time has no meaning anymore. This week I've heard with the president's tweet about the election being postponed and mail-in ballots and voter fraud. You see there are these phrases that are constantly being reiterated in right-wing media and across social media and key voices in the conservative movement plugging that idea into the voter's head. Does that worry you that this is a concerted effort to undermine the legitimacy of this election? Or do you think that this is just a regular concern that they have?
No, I think that this is, I mean, I first came across this concept in 2017 when I saw a meme that President Trump retweeted, and the meme was a yard sign, and it said Trump 2016, and then it said Trump 2020, and then Trump 2024, and it just kept going into
I
infinity.
saw that.
And I said, that's the meme. That's the beginning of this. I put that in the back of my head. I was like, okay, we're going to see this where he's going to look to do this sort of thing. I didn't want to believe it. I don't want to believe it. I mean, who wants to believe that? But I've been in a lot of places where that same thing has happened. And to think that it couldn't happen here or wouldn't happen here, that it's some sort of conspiracy theory is kind of hubris on our part. We're not above it. I think it could totally happen. I think it's you see that thing that happened in 2007, the meme that I saw, and then now this most recent tweet, where it seems like, oh, just a little dabble, right? Could this be the case, right? And then you see the State Department or the Justice Department come out and say, well, we're not going to say it can't happen, right? So that just it's boiling the frog, right? And it's a long-term campaign to do a certain thing. I mean, it could be. Like I don't know if it is,
Right.
but from my experience, that's the way you do it.
When you so when
That's
you
the
see
way.
this, it looks familiar to you.
Sure, you see the influence in it. You see that it starts off as a joke, right? It starts off as something that's not significant. Right. And then it becomes a little bit more, oh, that's plausible. And then you get people, and I'm not the target audience of that meme. I'm not the target audience. There's no way in hell I will ever be somebody who says, oh, yeah, we should definitely hold off on doing elections. That's not me. That's not the majority of Americans. That's a certain group of people that are more easily influenced with that sort of communication, right? It's those people that are saying, oh, well, for safety and security, did you notice? You know, it's all about safety and security. We want to be able to have safe and secure elections. So maybe we should
That seems
delay them.
reasonable. I want
Whereas
safe and secure elections.
I want safety and security. And if you rank high in safety and security in your belief structure, right, then you're going to tend to follow along with that message more. And you'll see it over time. They will pump up the safety and security message, and then they will also pump up the potential for delaying it, right? And you'll see that in a concerted effort. That's my opinion from
Right.
my experience. I mean, who
Yeah.
knows, but I hope it was just a dumb joke.
It doesn't. This does not appear to be a joke. He's doubled down. He's doubled down on it in interviews. And I've seen this like being repeated. This trying to undermine a lot of kickback, a lot of pushback, saying, "Oh, this is not serious." But also, like you said, this consistent messaging and ramping up this idea that there's this risk to the security of the election, and like, so what happens if? Let's say hypothetically, there are several key swing states where mail-in ballots decide the election, and it's going to take a while for them to come in. And so, election night, Donald Trump looks like he's up in Michigan. 3 weeks later, he's down because of the mail-ins, which is very possibly that something that could happen. And he says, "Well, this is bullshit. This is rigged. This is the biggest fraud in American history. I'm not leaving. This is." We're going to have a new election next year. That's unconstitutional. It's as far as I can tell. Only Congress could. And then there's a constant. I think they have to actually hold the election. Like his office ends on that date. So it doesn't seem legal. But what happens if he does it? What apparatus would you imagine would be charged with the actual removal of the president in that situation?
Jeez, I would have no idea, Tom. I mean, I would hope that the Secret Service would be responsible for protecting the President of the United States. And if he's not the President of the United States, then they would be responsible for protecting who is.
Right. But they would charge him with charge him with trespassing at the White House and escort him off the property, I guess, would be what I would expect would be the proper thing to do.
If you were to look at it from a straight cop perspective, hell yeah. I mean, he refuses to leave. He has no legal reason to be here. That go about it. But then you've got a Department of Justice that is not in a very good place either. I mean, who knows,
and
man?
And just so you know, I don't normally throw around all these hypotheticals. I've just been scared the past, for a couple of weeks now. I've been kind of...
Yeah, you know, I've always been a very big pragmatist, very centrist in my views. Growing up in Texas, growing up in the military, I'm not a left-leaning, crazy out there liberal. I'm a moderate liberal. I believe in, providing people with food stamps if they need food and good education for everybody. I mean, that's where I'm a liberal. But this is not that. This isn't, I'm not a conspiracy guy, but this has scared the hell out of me. This has got me into a place where, anybody should be concerned. Any conservative or Democrat or liberal should be concerned about what's going on. And man, I've never been one for a conspiracy guy, but if this doesn't have you scared right now, then I don't know what will.
Okay, well, that's a real sunny thought. I was hoping you'd cheer me up and make me feel better. I'm just teasing. let me just switch gears a little bit. I've kept you here already a long time. Do you have a couple more minutes here?
Yeah, I got a couple more minutes.
I just wanted to ask two more questions. One, I want you to we'll finish up. I just wanted you to tell me a little bit about the Pat Tillman Foundation. But before I get there,
sure.
There's one more question I was interested to ask you. In policing, we have these different checks on the use of violence by police officers. So you have this legal restrictions. So there are laws about what police can and can't do. They're very permissive. So police can do a lot in America and do it legally. Mm-hmm. And then you have these departmental policies. It's sort of the second layer. So you have the state, federal laws, and you have and local laws. And then you have these policies and restrictions by state police officer certification and departmental policy, these administrative level that is down on officers. And then you have this, I would call it this ethical layer. So it could be that it's legal. It could be that you're within your departmental policy to use violence, but because you at an individual level say, well, I could probably articulate this and I would be justified in doing it, but I'm going to take on, a little bit of extra risk because I don't want to use violence. I'm going to navigate this space because ethically I don't want to go home and think about that I did something that wasn't the right thing to do. So when you were in, because I was in the Army, I got out before September 11th. So I never went like a lot of my fellow veterans who've been, friggin' four or five different deployments. I've never had to deal with going to war. So in a war zone, how is violence controlled by soldiers, by their command staff, by the state in that environment? Is it similar? How so? How is it different? Can you just tell me a little bit about how violence is controlled?
Well, I mean, you have rules of engagement, ROE. The ROE is dictated by the commander, the commander. So at each level, they have different ROEs. Usually, like in Central Command, right, they had a certain rules of engagement. In Iraq, they had that rule of engagement, and it was very specific, right? And it did not deviate regardless of where you were or in what situation you were in. If you were engaging a hostile person or hostile force, you had a certain way or certain rules that you had to click, certain check marks. This group of people are obviously militants. They're uniformed. They're, firing. They're not firing, but they're about to fire. They're on the move. We'll light them up, right? That's very specific rules of their engagement. And this is like the infantry tactics, right? This is the basic job. Infantry guys don't just get to go and shoot things up, right? They have to have very specific rules that allow them to fire. And in my position, you know, it was not about ever firing, right? But you come across, I mean, I kind of have an affinity to these riot situations because we used to engage in riots, right? We used to work to find protests. You know, they'd call in the PSYOP team when protests were getting out of hand, right in front of the base, and it would be PSYOP team's job to get them all to calm down and go away or whatever needed to be done. So you would our rule of engagement, you know, even if I was to see somebody with an AK-47 in the middle of the crowd, right, my job wouldn't permit me to just shoot that guy, right? Because what's that going to do? It's not going to make anything better,
Oh.
right? It's going to make things a lot worse. So you engage that person. I mean, our job, you know, you take off your Kevlar, you open up your vest, you sling your weapon behind you, and you approach and you talk to them and you let them know that you're an individual and you're a person and they're a person, and you find that key communicator and you find out what's wrong. You find out what the problem is. Oh, your son died and he died because he picked up an IED, and that's why you're here. Okay, we can get you in front of the civil affairs folks, civil military operations, and we can find a solution, right? It's all about solution finding. Not blaming, not doing anything, but trying to answer questions and get people to chill the hell out. And that's what you do. That's my rule of engagement as a PSYOP guy, was to limit conflict as much as possible. It would never be okay for me to go about hitting people, like I've seen in so many videos, just willy-nilly. There's positions for us. It was all about self-defense. We're not an offensive group. I'm not going to see, you know, a bunch of bad guys on a gun truck moving up on us. I would call in somebody and be like, "Hey, there's a bunch of guys on a gun truck. Go take care of that." But even in situations where it could get bad, you have to wait for that last, very last moment. It's not so much about me going home. It's about, you know, the mission. And the mission for us was to limit violence or influence people. And you can't do that, you know, with a gun between you.
And
And you see
do
that.
you think that this the idea that is so deeply embedded in American policing culture that the highest priority is to go home at the end of your shift? That's it. That's, you know, no matter what, that needs to change, and that the idea of taking on additional risk should be framed as a valorous sort of heroic, highly valued way to perform as an officer, to be willing to go the extra distance to put yourself at risk. Is that what is that something you'd like to see?
Look, I would never want to say, oh, a cop's life is less important, but the cop's mission is more important, right? To be the peacemaker, to be that peace officer is more important than anything. If that's the oath you took, that's the oath, right? So, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, well, I think a cop should stand in front of the gun,
Right,
stand
obviously,
in front of that
right.
bullet.
I'm not talking about the
But
extreme. I'm talking about pushing it further than it is right now.
yeah, I think, but the thing is, for me, I think that that's not a very good analogy or a way of thinking, because in my way of communicating with people, you know, that rapport building, that reduces the
There you
likelihood
go.
that somebody's going to come on to me, right? It reduces the chance that I'm going to have to draw a weapon, right? That rapport building and interpersonal communication is the shield.
So it should be framed as a
That's,
way to make you safe, is by is the
yeah.
communicating. That makes total
Your
sense.
shield, I mean, you can wear all the body armor you want, but if somebody's going to shoot at you, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter. What really matters is get them not to want to shoot at you, right? I mean, there's going to be situations, right? You have biological issues. You have people that are high on PCP or whatever that are just going to do what they do. But you also have SWAT teams for those situations. You have tactics that you can employ to affect that. I think it hap I think these environments where people go to guns just way too fast. They don't take the time to communicate. They don't take the time. And in most instances, you can make distance. You can, why are you stopping that guy? I mean, if you think he's armed, you think he's a bad guy, he's driving down the road, you're going to do your pretext stop. Why don't you try to create distance? Make that into the policy. You know, make it, he's got to stop sometime. Dude has to pee, right? Everybody has to go to the bathroom. So find that moment. I don't know. I mean, like I said, I'm not a street cop, and I don't want to say that I know anything more than they do, because I don't. But from my perspective, I don't see a lot of communication first. I see the walls go up, and I see the effect of that, right?
I think that's one of the things that make this so valuable is hearing someone who's experienced a very similar cultural phenomenon, this type of domestic conflict and managing it in a military environment. You're going to have different approaches and ways of seeing the same phenomena. And if police officers, police administrators, they hear this, they think about it with a slightly different lens, they may gain some valuable insight. So I think it's extraordinarily valuable. So I normally ask this. I'm going to get you on your way. I've had you here longer than I promised. I normally ask this early on in the interview, but I was really excited to hear what you had to say about what's happening in the world, so I stumbled ahead. But we're our affiliation is through the Pat Tillman Foundation. We're both been supported by the Tillman Foundation. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about how you became aware of the Tillman Foundation, became a Tillman Scholar, and what it's sort of meant to you as an individual?
Sure. Well, I was a state investigator in 2009 and had my first kid. Had a high school degree, didn't have anything else, and decided if I was going to make sure to go to college someday, I should probably do it myself. So went and started getting my bachelor's in criminal justice and found out I was a pretty good student, that I could take my time to do it. I was working full time, but ended up with a fairly high GPA and was looking for some money to help to support that that endeavor. And really, this was early on. So the Tillman Foundation was just one of the many scholarships that you looked at. And so I applied and I got it. Surprisingly, I was very, very happy to get it at the time. But then, and at the time, it didn't really resonate what it was. It wasn't until my first, what we call a summit, where we meet other Tillman scholars, and we're sitting there in this room, in this auditorium, and everybody's standing up, like, oh, I'm an astrophysicist. They sit down and they're like, oh, I'm training to be a medical doctor, like 1,000 of those guys. And then it comes to me, after all these people are doing their amazing things, I'm going to be a senator someday. And it comes to me, and I'm like, oh, I'm getting my bachelor's degree in criminal justice. But thanks for having me. Totally thought that I should not be there and everybody else should. But then, over the week, I found out everybody had that exact same mentality. I mean, these people are just amazing. And each one of them is so humble and so from a place of gratitude that it was impossible not to just fall in love with every one of them. So I figured that if I could be in this group, then I could do a lot of things. So ended up, maxing out, getting my bachelor's degree and graduated at the top of the class and all that stuff. And then I was like, got my master's degree. I had never thought about any of this, right? I was just getting my bachelor's degree so I could move up in my department. but then I ended up getting my master's degree. And honestly, the scholarship money, that was great, but it was like in the way back, right? As soon as I hit that summit and I had this network of people that believed in me, these amazing people that believed in me in a way that I'd never believed in myself. Man, it opened up so many doors in my mind. It was probably the one of the most life-changing events in my whole life is becoming a Pat Tillman scholar. That's my spiel. Sorry.
No, that's a beautiful story. I'm going to put a link to the Pat Tillman Foundation in the description below on all the formats. And if anyone's worried about what's happening in America right now, and you want to empower, you know, veterans and veteran spouses who are passionate about important social causes and trying to insert themselves into positions of power and influence so they can evoke positive change in the world, and you want to support that type of activity, then head over and give 10, 15 bucks to the Tillman Foundation. It's definitely worthwhile. I've never met anyone who's been a part of it who hasn't had their life changed by it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I was just thinking about we're talking about having voices in the room. You know, people in the Pat Tillman Foundation are run across the political spectrum, but every single one of them, to a man or woman, will sit there and communicate with respect and love and with an honest, earnest desire to find a good outcome. And it's amazing. I've had conversations with people I don't agree with politically at all in the Pat Tillman Foundation, and they are my brothers and sisters, and I'd go to the mat for them any day, you know. And it's amazing that they can have such a powerful ability to communicate in a way that, you know, crosses party lines, it crosses everything. It really does consolidate voices in a way that empowers everybody in a way that it's just really amazing. So yeah, I totally would suggest anybody here to help empower those voices by contributing to the Pat Tillman Foundation.
Great. Check out the link in the description below, and I'll put Rick's information down there as well. Do you have any sort of parting thoughts before we say goodbye?
Whatever I said, we had a long conversation. I really want to make sure that it comes across that I'm not trying to be a armchair quarterback on anybody. I'm just trying to hell, I wouldn't even call myself that great of a soldier. I think I did a pretty good job over there. But honestly, I just have my perspective, and this is it. And I don't want to piss anybody off. But, you know, it's just what I got to say, I guess.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. I think this has been fascinating. I hope everyone else enjoyed it, and have a good day.